inform you guys, there's been an accident. Mike was in an accident. It's not grave, but he's unable to be here tonight. He's hurt. So, I'm sorry, we apologize. We will definitely...
We love you! We love Mike!
Our prayer, man, we
reschedule. We're gonna reschedule, and if you want tickets, will be refunded at point of purchase. I'm sorry.
Prayers for Mike!
On behalf of the band, we're really sorry. And let's wish Mike, you know, a speedy recovery.
Well, hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for fans and collectors of vinyl records. And this week we have on the show with us Justin Pearson, owner and chief muckety muck of 31G Records, bass player of Dead Cross, and member of heaps of hardcore and noisecore bands. Justin is on the show with us today to talk about his history with vinyl, starting and running 31G Records, the various bands he's been in, including Dead Cross, who are now zigzagging their way across the country. Go to facebook.com/deadcrossofficial for tour dates and 31G.com to order their new album. And this week's episode is brought to you by GrooveWasher.com. Clean your records with the best manual record cleaning system on the planet. Get a Groove Washer today at groovewasher.com. And we're also brought to you today by Voyage Air Guitars. Guitar players, check out the innovative design of the Voyage Air Guitar, designed for travel and built for quality. Check them out today at voyageairguitar.com. And with that, let's start our episode talking to Justin Pearson, owner of 31G Records and bass player for Dead Cross.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Hey, everyone. How you doing? It's Nate, host of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for fans and collectors of vinyl records. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for downloading us. Thanks for putting us in your ear holes today. It's always fun, isn't it? Hope you've had a good week. Hope you're not only living a good life, but also spinning some good music. I got some new records this week. I got a Jimi Hendrix Are You Experienced Mono UK on the Track label. And if you don't know what that is, that's okay. It's just kind of the first pressing, the highly desirable one. I put pictures of it up on Facebook and Instagram. Go to facebook.com/vinylguide or instagram.com/vinylguide if you want to check it out. Go ahead and follow us there, like us there, do what you got to do. But yeah, that's where I post all the new loot, so I'm pretty happy with that. Look, last week we also had a great episode featuring Sean Franklin, audio restoration engineer for the likes of Public Enemy, Chuck D, Anthrax, The Residents, The Mentors, heaps more. Sean's a good guy. He came on the show. He talked to us about his approach for mastering audio and how he goes through all those old tapes that the artists send him and catalogs them and finds all those hidden nuggets that hopefully will make it out on a release one day. So yeah, pretty fascinating episode. What a dream job, too. Can you imagine, like, you know, one of your favorite bands of your youth reaches out to you and sends you a box of tapes with rehearsals and live sets and outtakes and ask you to just go through them and make notes and advise on what you think would be good to release. That is just incredible. I'd love that. So very envious of Sean Franklin. And you probably will be too when you listen to the episode. Go check it out at thevinylguide.com. It's the Sean Franklin episode, Audio Restoration Engineer. All righty. So this week on the show, we have with us Justin Pearson, owner of 31G Records, member of a bunch of different bands, as well as currently the bass player for the band Dead Cross. Now, if you're not familiar with Dead Cross, they're like a hardcore, noisecore band. I mean, I really don't want to label them. Their sound is really kind of genre-defying, but, you know, if I say hardcore and noisecore, at least you kind of know where in the musical continuum they circumlocute, right? But they have got a really unique sound because of the lineup that's come together to form Dead Cross. You've got on vocals Mike Patton, who is from Faith No More, Mr. Bungle, Tomahawk, Phantomos, a bunch of different projects. Mike, he really is a genius in his vocal performance and writing and performance. So, man, he's just having him on front is amazing. But behind him is Dave Lombardo, who you may recognize from Slayer, just a bunch of different bands. He's just a brilliant drummer, super fast, just like a clock. So, you know, Dave Lombardo's on the drums, Mike Crane on guitar, who you may know from Retalks and a few other bands, and then Justin is on the bass. And again, Justin's been in heaps of different bands, which we're going to talk about today. He's the owner of 31G Records. So really, this four-piece is just sonically amazing. And I picked up their latest album, just simply called Dead Cross. I got it at 31G Records. That's 3-T-H-R-E-E-O-N-E. Letter G.com. And I had it sent international. And let me tell you, not only was the shipping cheap, but it was super quick. I ordered it on a Thursday. It was shipped from Los Angeles and arrived Tuesday in Sydney. So amazing speed. And again, you know, I would encourage everyone here to check out the new Dead Cross album. Go to 31G.com. Order yourself a copy. They've got a red limited edition marbled copy, which I got, and it's got a glow-in-the-dark cover and everything. It's quite cool. You can pick that up at 31G.com. So if you don't mind, let me just take a quick minute to tell a quick anecdote about this interview, and it'll give you an idea of the type of guy that Justin is and the type of band that Dead Cross is. I think it's, you know, I was really fascinated by this, but let me just quickly describe. Whenever we do a Vinyl Guide interview, they're generally scheduled about a week in advance. All right. So myself, the artist, the PR person, the band management, everyone has this synchronized calendar, and we're able to say, okay, on this particular date, at this particular time, you know, we're going to do the interview, you know, for the feature. So we had our interview scheduled with Justin. I believe Dead Cross was playing Texas, not exactly which town, but the interview was supposed to take place at 6:30 p.m. that evening. And it was supposed to be right after the Dead Cross sound check, but before the live show. So at the given time, Justin and I connect. We have the conversation. Everything began on time. It ran to time. Everything was fine. There was no reason to think that anything was different. Okay. And mind you, this is probably, like, again, it went till probably from 6:30 to maybe 7:30 their local time. Now, a few hours later, you know, I'm off doing something different, and I see, come across social media, a picture of Justin in handcuffs. I was, oh my God, well, I just talked to this guy. Now he's on all over the place, all over the news, all over Facebook, all over Instagram, in handcuffs. Actually, it was Justin and the guitar player, Mike, both in handcuffs outside of a cop car. And that picture was posted, I believe, by Dave Lombardo, who was there. And apparently something happened with Justin and Mike. I don't think, not between them, but I mean, just something happened and the police got involved. Now, the band hasn't said what it was or really anything. I think there's some kind of legal protection they're trying to, you know, you can't say anything. You don't want to say anything, right, publicly. But the timing of the photo was just before the interview that I had with Justin. So essentially, on August 16th, Justin, at some point around midday or shortly thereafter, was in some sort of police altercation. You know, he went from a cop car to sound check to talking with us here on the Vinyl Guide. And I thought that was just amazing. You know, I mean, here's this guy. He's, you know, he's very busy. He's traveling around. Obviously, he's had this very, well, I believe it's hopefully a very unique experience, a very unpredictable experience, some altercation or whatever. I mean, it's not just, you don't get put in handcuffs just for running a stoplight, right? I mean, there's a story behind there. But the fact that Justin kept his time, kept the interview, kept things going, huge respect to the guy for just keeping that train going, right? I mean, this is a band that can't be stopped. I mean, well, mind you, a few days later, there was a car accident where Mike Patton did have some injuries and they had to cancel a show. I think they postponed the show, but they're back to playing live again. So it's been a hell of a week for Dead Cross. But really, when you think about it, this is a band that cannot be stopped. Neither police nor car accidents nor anything else is going to stop this band. But I would advise you guys, if you want to see the band, you probably want to see them as quickly as possible, because God knows what else is going to happen. So make sure you go to facebook.com/deadcrossofficial for the tour dates. Pick up their new album at 31g.com and see this band. They are fantastic. And again, big props, big respect to Justin for just making this happen. It is interesting. You'll hear in the interview, at one point I ask him, so how's the first week of the Dead Cross tour going? And he has this very odd laugh. Listen for it. I didn't think much of it at the time, but after a while, you know, a couple days later when I was doing the editing and I heard that laugh, knowing what had just happened a few hours before, it's a little bit more revealing than it was at the time. So anyway, here we go. We're getting ready to talk to Justin of 31G Records and the awesome band Dead Cross, and we'll be back with the interview right after this.
Well, great Googly Moogly, the world's bestest, most famousest record cleaner groove washer, has a brand new little brother.
The Groove Washer Stylus Brush. Now, you all know that Groove Washer is the best manual record cleaning system in the world, bar none, and that the Groove Washer cleans your records and ensures your vinyl sounds its absolute best while protecting your vinyl investment.
However, one link in your sound system that rarely gets considered is the actual stylus.
And dirt can build up on your stylus and affect your sound. Imagine the windshield of a car. It collects spots, dust, and debris, even on the best of days. And if you have dirty records, well, that's like just driving through a mud puddle. The new Groove Washer Stylus Brush is like a fresh pair of windshield wipers, wiping clean the stylus, enabling it to be clean and capture the most detailed sound quality of your vinyl. And the best part, the Stylus Brush is available right now for the low introductory price of $14.95. Holy moly, that's cheap. The Groove Washer Stylus Brush is available at groovewasher.com for only $14.95 for a limited time only. Get in now, and while you're at it, pick yourself up a record cleaning kit starting at less than $30. Head over to groovewasher.com now and get yours today. That's groovewasher.com, and they are made in the USA.
Now, I know that many of you record collectors are also musicians, so let me share with you a word on Voyage Air guitars. Guitars are fun to play, they're great to carry around, but they're pretty awkward. You have this body of the guitar, and then you have this long, thinnish, exposed neck, which could be subject to damage when you transport it. Now, I'm sure you've all seen and heard the horror stories of airlines damaging guitars in transit. However, with a Voyage Air guitar, you don't need to worry about that. Voyage Air guitars have a patented hinge system, which allows the neck to fold down for protection and allowing easy access for storage and transportation. And when it's time to play, simply unfold the neck and voila! Instantly playable guitar with tuned strings. Now, I've used these guitars before. The system they have is incredible. You got to see it for yourself. Go to voyageairguitar.com or ask your local guitar dealer how you can check out this amazing guitar system. Never worry again about your guitar. Get yourself a Voyage Air guitar. The future is unfolding. This week on the show, we have Justin Pearson, the guy behind 31G Records, member of half a dozen hardcore, or grindcore, noisecore bands such as Holy Molar, The Locust, Retox, and current member of Dead Cross, whose debut album just came out. I believe it's album of the year, personally. All the rest of you pukes can stop now. We have a winner. Justin, how are you holding up with the album coming out and really making a huge splash out there?
I'm doing decent. It's a weird way to phrase the question. I'm holding up just fine.
Okay, good. I believe it's the feel good hit of the summer. I smell Grammy.
It's too weird, man. It's too weird for that territory, I think. But thank you very much.
No worries. Look, I, all kidding aside, it is a fantastic album, and it's really come out of the gate really strong. It's got a lot of great press, and I believe it really adds something new to the whole genre of hardcore music. It's a tweak. It's an improvement on the formula, and I think this is going to be the start of, you know, us going in a slightly different direction than where we've been for the past, you know, 10 years or so. So congratulations. I think you guys really hit it out of the park. So before we get into Dead Cross, let's just kind of go back a bit. You started 3-1-G Records about 15 years ago. Is that right?
I think it was about 21 years ago.
Mm. Okay. And what made you want to start a record label?
Well, when I was 15, I started playing music. I released something on Ebullition, which I think at the time just had really great standards as far as packaging and music in general. And so by default, I sort of just had this like expectation of what I guess another label would do. So when I ended up releasing my first band, second single or whatever, we did a split single with another label, it was just a bunch of crap. I mean, the cover art was changed without our approval. It was pressed with you had a pressing, which is at the time was like pretty bad quality. And then it was just weird all around. The advertisements looked kind of crappy. And, we had no idea what was being pressed. And I don't know. I looked at the record thinking like I could at least do it myself, like this shitty. It just so turned out that I was in a band called Swing Kids at the time, and the guitar player was also an Unbroken. So the first two records that I released were an Unbroken single, and then I re-released the Swing Kids 7-inch EP. So I was able to put out two records right away that were fairly well-known bands or active bands at the time, and that was a, you know, for me it was a great start of a label. So that's how it kind of came about.
Was it hard to get distribution? Was it hard to get those records in the shops?
Yeah, but I think since like both bands were touring, and I just had like some sort of different expectations or like sort of like assumptions of how to move product. You know, it wasn't like we were selling more than 1,000 at a time, it wasn't as hard as I guess it should have been. Mainly like getting into stores and distribution companies like smaller distributors were easy. The problem was getting people to pay up when they were acting as a distributor, you know, like sending someone, 20 or 30 or 50 copies of a 7-inch and then never hearing from them again was a bummer, especially since, you had to, pay for long distance phone calls or whatever to try to even find the person that has the record. So it was a bit of a drag in that sense, but it wasn't really hard to get people to want to, the other distributors to take, these records. It wasn't like they were unknown bands at the time.
So really it wasn't so hard getting them out there. It was actually collecting the, the dough.
Yeah. There was a lot of times where people didn't pay.
So I imagine you guys sold the majority of your stuff at your shows?
Part of it was live or like touring or whatever, but then also it was just sort of, I think at the time, 3-1-G was able to kind of, without even understanding this term, like able to brand itself. So it was like, there was like, the fact that it was from San Diego, and there was like Gravity Records at the time and Vinyl Communications at the time, and kind of a lot of stuff happening in San Diego. There was a lot of attention on certain bands. And so like at the time of me releasing these first two 7-inches, shortly after started the Locust, and we would go out and do full US and European tours. And so I could just bring any record that I was putting out with me and essentially end up selling them at shows, because no one could really get them, it was kind of, it was different. It wasn't like you could just go online and like look up something. It was like going to a show, and it was a little bit more special. And you would see these records, and it was kind of more intriguing, I suppose. And also, people would have to take the risk of, like, either, you know, purchasing it and taking it home to hear what it was, or just miss out on it completely. So I think that, you know, if you're going to a show at that time, you would probably be more apt to buy a copy of a 7-inch, especially since the, you know, back then it was like, you know, either like $2 or $2.50 or something for a 7-inch, you know, and that was something that you'd kind of need to pick up to figure out what it even was.
Now, this was, just kind of doing the math, this was 96, 97-ish. Records weren't really the popular medium at the time. Why 7 inches?
Well, I mean, vinyl was the kind of medium for me. I mean, maybe cassettes, but you couldn't burn CDs at that point yet, I don't think. That didn't come until, what year would that be?
It was probably around late 90s. You could start burning CDs, but in the stores, or the way people were listening to music, were really more CD oriented. And then I remember around the mid 90s, people were getting rid of their collection. So it's, to me, it's always interesting when a label, how a label made it through the 90s, producing vinyl.
Well, there was, okay. So the part of it was, for me, was I still feel like people were generally interested in vinyl over CD format at that point. But also 3-1-G started out by putting out like five inch picture disc and a square 7-inch and a heart shaped 10-inch. And so there was more to it. It was more like an artifact, you know, like a piece of art, I guess, than like just like a round regular black vinyl record. There was something, I think, more special to it. And it was something that tied in more than just music. It was, a thing that you wanted to kind of own because it was cool. And I guess like maybe intriguing to certain people or something.
Oh, they're beautiful records. And that's what's always kind of interested me about the records that 3-1-G makes. The 7-inches, even to this day, are beautifully packaged. You could tell that there's a lot of care and thought and design that goes into it. When you take one home, it's a pleasure. It makes you feel you're proud that you own one. But it certainly, there's a lot of cost that goes into that. So it's interesting. The 7-inches, do you see, I mean, in your mind, are 7-inches, do you make much money off them, or are they more promotion for the band and something
else?
Yeah,
not a viable source of income whatsoever. I mean, even if you were to put out, you know, a pretty run-of-the-mill black vinyl 7-inch, I mean, you're not going to see that much profit from it. I mean, it could, just because there's this sort of guideline of what it can be sold for. So, I mean, I did struggle with it for a while because there was times where I was realizing, like, you know, putting out like the Swing Kid 7-inch, for instance, you know, was interesting because it was like black vinyl, black and white cover. It was very minimal. There was nothing special necessarily to it. And then I'd put out like the Cattle Decapitation Homivore LP, which was a gatefold, full color, cow colored vinyl with a full color inner sleeve, you know, so it was just like a little bit absurd as far as the packaging, and you would never ever, well, you would never see any profit, maybe even never recoup. So it was tricky. And I think it was a learning process because at some point I started realizing like, I can't afford this, you know, I can't afford to put a record out and lose money. And I need to pay for, you know, once the label is getting bigger and putting out 50, 60, 70 copy releases, you know, you'd have to have like a storage space or an office or somewhere to do the work. And it was just not feasible. So there were times where I kind of had to scale back. I mean, if it was up to me, everything would be just absurd as far as packaging. So yeah, I mean, it just depends on the release and the project, I suppose.
Did your approach to releasing music on vinyl change as we started getting things like Napster and file sharing and even online distribution? How did that impact what you did?
Well, for me, like, let's say 3-1-G number 21, I think, was the Blood Brothers March on Electric Children LP. Like, at the time, like, I had to get, you know, I gave them like a $5,000 recording budget, which was a lot of money for me. It still is a lot of money for me, but it was a lot of money for me at that point. It's like giving them like this money and then manufacturing a gatefold LP that was full color with a colored inner sleeve and colored vinyl. Actually, it wasn't. It was a. There was like a booklet inside that was full color. It was regardless. The price, the packaging was absurd. So the amount of money that I spent on that was through the roof. And then to see that it was available online illegally before I was even able to sell one copy was a little defeating. But it's something that I got used to, and I think most labels got used to it. You know, and a lot of people had like business smarts and I didn't, you know, and a lot of people were very cautious and I wasn't. And so I think that might have set me aside from it, you know, and luckily enough for me, I think there's a bit of smoke and mirrors involved where I just kind of tricked people or, you know, just kind of like said, fuck it. And like kept, you know, plugging away and trying to figure out a way to make ends meet or try to make things work. Where a lot of other people would have just been like, this is garbage. I'm going to bail. I'm going to forget about doing this and it's not worth it. But I think maybe for me was like, I was part of the label and I was part of a lot of the releases. So I kept thinking like when other labels started folding or when the industry was kind of getting, you know, hit harder with like, the inability to make any kind of money. You know, I just kind of was like, where am I going to put like, you know, the Holy Molar catalog or like the Crimson Curse releases, like where's it going to go? You know, like, is it going to exist still or is it going to just be done? So it was an interesting thing to think about. And I, since I didn't really have an answer for that, I just kept doing the label. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure yet if that's a good or bad thing. We could probably, well, give it another 10 years and we have an accurate answer.
Well, that times like that generally separate the people who are in it for the money versus the people who are in it for the art and the passion of it. And the fact that you have navigated those waters and where file sharing was this big dark cloud over the music industry. I think now, and let me know if you disagree, I think a lot of people now embrace file sharing as a way to get the music out there and to promote some of the things that are coming up. Do you think it's now transitioned into a good thing?
You know, I don't know if it's good or bad. It's a fairly loaded question. It's a fairly massive question. So it's interesting because I think people's expectations and standards have constantly been shifting. Because for one, when we started playing music, it was a sheer necessity. You know, like it was like we were trying to survive by playing music and doing this thing that we had. It was our voice, and we did what we did, and it was never like we're doing this because we would have been full of shit if we were like, oh, we're going to make money off of this. It was just like, this is what we have to do. This is like, it wasn't like it was like fun. It wasn't that it was like something that was like, you know, again, we weren't going to like monetarily benefit from it. It was just something like, you know, the universe was like, you're going to do this and this is who you are. And so we would do something. And then at some point it shifted and some people started making money and some people didn't. And if, you know, I think that me and a lot of the people that I worked with never changed our sort of expectations. We just did what we had to do. And I think it was a little bit more honest. It wasn't like, a paycheck. And maybe that's a good or bad thing that it was never presented to us like that. But, it just was something that was part of the way of life for a lot of us. And then, you know, it's just, yeah, I mean, it's a strange question how to look at it. So when people got upset about the fact that file sharing became a thing and that, you know, your record would be essentially just kind of taken and given away for free before you could ever make any money or even recoup, I mean, I see why people would be upset. I mean, I was sort of disappointed, you know, but what are you going to do? You know, like, you can either complain or just stop, you know, or just roll with it. And I think that, you know, me and a lot of my bandmates at the time or people that I was working with just kind of like rolled with it.
So right now you're still undecided on file sharing, good thing or bad thing?
I mean, it's there. I don't really care either way. What am I going to do? Like, I mean, it's fine. It's easy for me to give someone our record, but hey, I'll just email you the record. I don't have to go to the post office and mail them CD or, you know, an LP. So I guess that's convenient. And as far as like seeing money, it's like, well, it's just it's just how it is. It's kind of like, it's just how it is. You know, you can't do anything about it.
As a record label, I imagine you have a lot of stock of older releases, even during those times that recordings were leaked and, you know, maybe you got stuck with a few boxes or more of a particular product. Do you have a warehouse just full of old 3-1-G releases?
Yeah, I have a storage space that's full of shit that I'll never, ever sell. I can't even give half of it away. It's pretty insane. And I would totally give it away if I could. But I can't bring myself to just put it in the trash, you know, because it's stuff that I feel, you know, is valuable. Not, again, not monetarily, but it's valuable. You know, for instance, like this band Jax, nobody really knows who they are. They're pretty short-lived. And they later became... well, the band that's better known as Celebration now. So it's like people from Celebration. But I can't, I probably have 700 of those CDs in a storage space, or like the Airborn Radar stolen single CD. Like I have about 1,000 of those, you know, I'll never sell them, but I'd rather just hand them out and give them away to people and have them, you know, hear something that's, I think special or you know, useful or whatever, you know. It's just, again, I just can't find myself throwing it away.
Are we going to see it on Storage Wars one time, some year down the road? Well,
maybe if I don't pay my storage space. But yeah, I did this. I mean, I recently did this thing with these Locust. I did put out a Locust CD EP a long time ago that was, the actual disc was square. So it's, first of all, no one can play it, and if they wanted to, because you have to have like a front loading CD player. And then it's a CD as well, so no one cares. So, you know, I did this thing where I was like, just send me $20 and I'll mail you a box of these CDs. It was 70, I think there's 72 CDs in a box, and it cost me $19 to ship them. So, you know, I made about a dollar, and you know, which doesn't even cover my gas to the storage space and then to the post office. But I probably sold 1,000 of those. In about a week, just by doing that. And what people do with a box of 72 Locust CDs is beyond me. I'm sure some people are trying to sell them, and I wish them luck. And if they do sell them, it's a little frustrating because I can't fucking sell them. So why get someone else? But regardless, I figured, like, hey, that's kind of interesting. Like, it'd be cool to just get these records out, or these CDs out into the world, and let someone else deal with them. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, even if they give them away to people, like, that's rad and weird. And it was kind of just like a weird kind of thing to try to see what happens, you know, see how it unfolds.
So is vinyl your preferred medium to listen to things on, or are you?
Yeah, I think CDs are garbage. I mean, I always kind of struggled with them, but I think vinyl is a more valuable format. And I think that there's a resurgence. I mean, vinyl sales have been, I guess, like within the last 20 years, are at an all-time high right now. So that's saying something right there. But I think vinyl in general is just a lot cooler. I mean, even the packaging is more interesting, and it's kind of just nicer to have something that's physically a little bit larger and has something to it. You know, like when you download an album, you know, you get like a JPEG of a cover. You don't get to see the artwork or liner notes or lyrics, and you don't get to kind of experience it in a different way that I think maybe a lot of people never got the chance to, or never really understood, you know, the value in it. You know, like getting an album and putting it on, you know, your turntable and being able to kind of look through the artwork and read along and see, you know, like the sort of like textural aspects to a record beyond the sounds. You know, I mean, there's something more to it than just like the actual songs, you know, being played as an MP3 or whatever.
There's the experience, the ritual, the, you know, just putting it on, focusing a bit, absorbing yourself in it. Yeah. So how would you describe your personal music collection? Do you have a lot of vinyl? Do you have still a handful of CDs? Is it mostly current stuff, old stuff? Like, how would you describe, you know, your personal listening area?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's predominantly mainly vinyl. I mean, I do have a lot of CDs, not as much, of course. I mean, I even have like some 8-tracks and stuff like that, but those are just more novelty. But I think, I don't know, I have all kinds of weird stuff. I mean, I always would prefer more limited pressings or rare pressings over stuff that's kind of not as, I guess, special or something.
Do you go out to record shops that often and pick up used records?
I do. I wouldn't say often because it's dangerous. But yeah, I do when I can, and definitely if I'm going to sell stuff, I'll kind of look through and end up screwing myself and buying stuff that I probably shouldn't spend money on. But yeah.
What are your go-to record shops?
Well, you mean like in San Diego where I live?
Yeah. Yeah. Or when you're on tour, what are the ones you look forward to visiting while you're traveling?
I mean, there's places like Amoeba that are just insane. No matter what, I'm going to leave there feeling like I just screwed myself, you know, but I mean, in San Diego, there's, a lot of awesome spots. There's, Feel It. There's Reanimated, which just opened, M Theory, Red Dinosaurus. I mean, there's a lot of new places popping up too, which is pretty rad. And that in itself says quite a lot too. I mean, seeing like newer spots, you know, there's probably more record stores now than there were 5 or 10 years ago, I would say.
Yeah. A lot of people jumping into it now. Hopefully the trend continues to support them all. Is there any particular record that you're looking for these days? Like, when you go to the record shop, what's the first area or the first bin that you go to look for something?
I don't know. That's a really good question. I mean, I guess I'm always drawn towards what's on the wall because it seems like it's sort of put up for a reason, you know. It's gonna be like a sort of like a rare gem, you know. So I kind of like check that stuff out first of all. But I mean, a lot of times it's a little bit pricey, and that is a concern to me sometimes, you know. But I mean, there's nothing really in specific that I can think of off the top of my head that I'm looking for currently. But you know, I mean, I don't know. When I was in before this tour in LA for a while, I went to Amoeba and. You know, I'll just do like a quick lap, you know, and of course I like see this PIL box set that's $180, you know, mm-hmm. And I didn't even know it existed. And I was just like, shit, you know, I don't have $180. Like, I didn't buy it obviously, but like, you know, it's, yeah, my luck. That's a thing that I would see and want or whatever, you know?
So you didn't figure out a way to make it happen. You just, okay, some other time maybe.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the universe will present it to me in a more suitable manner. But when I'm in LA for a week or whatever, rehearsing and broke, you know, I don't think I could justify it. Like, I mean, there's nothing that I could justify. I just don't have the ability to spend that much money on a final, really.
Yeah, and there's no such thing as a quick lap through Amoeba, by the way.
There's not, and it sucks. It's like stupid for me to even think like that. I should just stop at the door and turn around, you know.
Yeah. What bands inspired you in your youth? And is there an album that you recall really changing you?
Well, yes. Man, that's a good question. Well, the things that kind of, I remember like having cassettes when I was younger and I mean, I had vinyl too, but I remember like not really having like a connection to vinyl until I was about 10 or 11. And, I don't know how it worked out. I mean, I guess, that's a good question. I was really into the Thrasher skate rock compilations. And so I had a couple on cassette, a couple on vinyl, and then one of them came out. It was a shaped picture disc. Thing was shaped like a skateboard, like a half of a skateboard or whatever. And I remember kind of tripping out on the fact that it was like this, you know, kind of like absurdly creative thing. And then I think shortly after that, I found a Cramps picture disc that came with 3D glasses. And then that was it. I was like, vinyl is the raddest thing. And I just obsessed over weird stuff. And then, you know, like fast forward a couple of years, I was really into the Sex Pistols of sort of a couple of years. I remember having like 13 different copies of Nevermind the Bollocks, you know, and it was just like having it with the submission sticker on the back, or having it with the yellow and pink versus the orange and green, or things like that, or even like having variations of like the Septic Death album. You know, one of them had a border, one of them didn't. Things like that were just fascinating to me. I remember it was like the band Stupids and someone else, like, it was like Stupids and Hard-Ons, like Flexi. And then I got a PCH Infest Flexi. And I remember just thinking like, God, you know, records are so weird and crazy and cool and fascinating, you know, because it was like, wasn't just the music to me at that point. There was this cool art, and cool artistic aspects, you know, that linked to it. It was like this physical thing that you just kind of wanted to obtain. And especially for me, like, you know, I grew up like collecting Star Wars toys and like being really into things like that. Like that was all important to me. Like looking at like the cards of, you know, the back of the action figures was like really rad. And, it just sort of seemed like that to me. You know, I mean, I was 10 years old, so it was still like kind of, I mean, I wasn't really into Star Wars toys at that point. You know, I was kind of into skateboarding and shit, but I remember like just having the same feeling with records that I did with toys. So it kind of seemed like, I don't know, like I'm growing up and this is what I'm getting into now, you know? So
it sounds like you had the DNA of a collector. You know, you're looking at all the different variations and all the different, you know, fascinated sure. by the, you know, and then wanting to have them all.
Yeah. But I mean, a good point. I remember like thinking like, you know, I really liked early PIL. I remember having second edition, and I remember having the metal box, which is the same record. And second edition just wasn't cool compared to the metal box. Mm-hmm. I just wanted the metal box, you know, the way it was packaged was so much more interesting to me. It's same music, you know, same band or whatever. It was just, I don't know. It was like that, being able to like rationalize like why one was better than the other, drew me towards being a record collector.
Do you still have those records from your youth?
Yeah. Well, most of them. I mean, you know, a lot of times we'd have like house shows and people would spill shit for me and I'd realize things were missing, but I do have a lot of really important stuff, that I've held on to since I was 10 or 11 years old. Yeah.
So becoming a musician, how was the transition from being music listener to being musical participant?
Well, the first, I think you know, I was going to shows with my friends and for whatever reason, you know, my first band, me and three of my friends just so happened to be able to, you know, there was bass, drums, vocals, and guitar, right? You know, and so we played, we started a band. And I remember like the first time I ever recorded, it was with this band Struggle. We were on this compilation called the Give Me Back compilation, which was released by Ebullition. And the packaging was just beautiful and it was so interesting. And it was like this giant booklet and it just had so much to it. And I was also on a record with bands like Bikini Kill and Downcast and Born Against. And I was like, it felt crazy. You know, I felt like, I mean, I didn't think I was up to par with some of my peers or my elders, but I was so grateful and so, I don't know, like just, amazed that I was able to be part of something that these other people were that I really did respect and look up to, and admire, you know, and so I'm grateful that my first kind of like, you know, I guess my first like, sort of dabble into that world of like being, you know, I don't want to call myself a musician because I don't even know if that's an accurate, you know, definition or whatever, but like playing music and being on a record was like, it wasn't like I was just putting out a cassette demo, you know, I was like, fuck, I'm on this compilation that's so badass. It's got so many rad bands and it stands for something that I really was passionate about. Felt really good, you know?
Mm-hmm. And it seems like that level of energy hasn't decreased. It's only increased. You seem to be in a lot of bands. Why multiple bands rather than focusing on one or two?
Well, that's interesting because I don't perceive it that way. Like currently right now, I mean, I'm active with Dead Cross and I'm active with Retox. You know, one band I sing in and one band I play bass in. It doesn't seem like much of a conflict. I also have a recording project called Planet B, which I just sing in primarily. But there's not a lot of overlap, or like, it's not like I'm too busy or trying to spread myself thin or doing all this shit. You know, like, my bass playing is dedicated to Dead Cross and my lyric writing is dedicated to Retox and Planet B. And it seems fairly simple in that sense. You know, I mean, The Locust is on hiatus, not by my choice. And, I don't think I have any other bands that are active, you know? So, I mean, it's never really like, I mean, only at one point was it like, I was like, fuck, this is crazy. I was in The Locust and Some Girls both full time touring, like sort of back to back and recording back to back. And it was a little bit, you know, strenuous, I guess. I remember being on tour with Some Girls mixing, The Locust New Eruptions, like via email, you know, and I was just like, fuck, I need to be at home or be in the studio, you know? And so it was, but never did I really have like an issue with like it being too many things. I mean, and it's never like that. I want to just start a project and then bail on it. For whatever reason, it just stops. It's never like, I don't just like jump ship or whatever. For whatever reason, the life of span of certain things only should or does last a certain amount of time.
Look, it makes perfect sense in terms of the approach and, you know, having a project and starting a different project. But it seems like there's a lot of that where a lot of bands tend to traditionally come together for, you know, 5-6 years or more sometimes.
Sure.
You have a lot of different.
Yeah, but I mean, okay, so when I grew up, it seemed like bands only lasted 2 years. I don't know why. Maybe because I was 15 and 16 and people were going to college or something. I don't know. But all these bands that I was like familiar with was like 2 years or a year. And then I remember like at some point being like, fuck, I've been in The Locust for 10 years or now it's been 20, you know? It's weird. So there's things like that. But for the most part, like you had mentioned Holy Moeller at the beginning of this interview, I believe. And so like, Holy Moeller was never a band. It was like, hey, there's a guy that lives in New York. There's a guy that lives in Portland. There's, you know, three guys that live in San Diego. Let's come together and like, let's record. And we would record and that would be it. And then at one point we did a 2-week tour and then we disbanded, you know, like we just kind of like got busy with our lives or didn't care anymore. It was just like a thing. It was never supposed to be like a band. And even things like Head Wound City, I mean, that was the same thing. It's like, you know, you have people in Seattle, LA, San Diego, New York. It's just like, But it's like, should I not have, you know, worked on a record with these people? Like, they're my friends. I love them. I admire them. I think that they're brilliant. I would love to work on something and create something with them. So let's do it. So it happens. It's not just like, hey, fuck it. Like, we did a record. Let's break up. You know, it wasn't ever like a band necessarily that you could just break up, if that makes any sense. I mean, Head Wound City is a great example. We got together. We recorded, I think, 7 minutes of music, something very short like that. Maybe it was more than 7 minutes. Anyhow, we recorded an EP, we played one show, and then it took 10 years until we were able to play again. And that was cool, I guess, but there was no like standard or stipulation. It was just kind of like, well, you know, it's going to take a while till we can do something again. And that's how it worked out.
Yeah. Well, that's refreshing. That's interesting how, you know, you create art with different people, you move on, maybe you go back, but it's, you know, you keep moving forward, which is cool. So Dead Cross, in the bio, it's mentioned it formed on November 30th, 2015, an exact date. What happened on November 30th, 2015?
To be honest, I have no clue.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know because, Ross Robinson asked myself and Mike Crane to come and track on, someone's demo, that he was working on, with Dave Lombardo. So we got together with this singer songwriter and did 3 songs with her, on her for an album. And, pretty soon into us working with her in the studio, this thing came up where Lombardo said, I have these 3 shows. I have to, I have to do something. I have to put a band together to play these three shows. I have to fill this slot. And, you know, so Mike Crane was like, oh, we should get a band. We should just play those three shows and write, you know, some music. And I remember thinking, like, you know, they asked me to do you want to do this? And I was like, sure. I'm like, but you realize it's in 12 days, you know? And so we kind of just, like, somehow wrote what is now our album in 12 days and then played these shows. And then the three shows turned into 5 and 9. And I think we played 9 shows total. And we recorded them. I guess that is a date, of some sort, but yeah.
Okay.
To be honest, I don't even know what today is. I don't know what date it was, but it was a little while ago. Yeah.
So Dead Cross originally had a different vocalist, Gabe Serbian, who left. And then, from what I understand, Lombardo reached out to Mike Patton, asked him to join. He obviously agreed. How was your reaction to this whole exchange?
Well, I'll be honest. It was very devastating when Gabe kind of finally just said he had to part ways with the band. And we all respected that and understood why. And that was that. I think in retrospect, I probably should have been a little bit more concerned, but I had very little expectations. I didn't really know what this project would become. You know, again, it was supposed to just be 3 live shows, and then it kind of just escalated into something else. But it was strange, you know. I knew something would come about it. Of the transition of singers, and we had talked with a couple other people who were interested. So regardless, I knew like we were going to be fine, and something was going to come about of Dead Cross, regardless. And then, you know, Patton was one of the few people that we had sort of brought up as potential singers, and I mean, I didn't really think he would be able to do it. And then when he said yes, it was awesome. I think we all have, you know, we all had like personal relationships and stuff. So it made a lot of sense. And then but again, none of us really had expectations of what the like sort of level of what the band would become would be. Like, you know, initially it was just kind of like, oh, we'll just record. And then wasn't even discussed like live or touring or anything. And then it became, you know, live and then touring and here we are, you know? So it kind of fits into the category of all the other kind of weird things that we had been talking about where it wasn't like set up, like we're going to start this band and we're going to be a band for 10 years. You know, it was just kind of like, see what happens and it could possibly work out and it could possibly not. And that was kind of like, there was no expectations. And I think that maybe that might be a little bit more genuine, a little bit more honest overall, I suppose.
From what I understand, the album was recorded with Gabe on vocals, but Mike came in and did his vocals over the original tracks. How different were the songs to the ones that ended up on the album?
Well, he didn't do all of the songs. I think he did maybe like 3/4 of it. There was a few tracks that were not tracked with Gabe yet, but it's hard to say because there was only I think maybe 3 that were even really kind of done with Gabe's vocals, and so there was never like that we never really had the ability to sort of like let it sit in or become familiar with them beyond, you know, the whole thing is done in a very unorthodox manner. I mean we never really had a lot of time with the material and on any level. So it wasn't until Patton kind of jumped in the, you know, in the mix and tracked. And until we started mixing the album was like kind of the first time that for me, I was able to really wrap my head around what the material actually was.
Okay. So there was no expectations early on. It was still forming and Patton came in.
I mean, there was, yeah, the first expectation was let's start a band that sounds like Infest, and you know we sound nothing like Infest. So I mean you have to start somewhere and say like let's do this thing. But I mean if you consider the people that are playing the music, there's going to be some sort of level of, you know, I mean there's going to be elements of style to it to some degree. You know, I mean unless you want to just be a ripoff of something and sound like Invest or whatever, you know, I mean, we just sort of had like a kind of launching point. And then once we started working on material, it became something, you know, and again, I don't think we even knew what it was until you're handed the final mix of the album and you can kind of like let it sink in.
Are you thinking right now this is a one-off album, or do you think there's going to be more Dead Cross in the future?
Good question, man. I mean, we wrote new material to play live. We all get along very well, and we all work very well together. So I see no reason why it won't, you know, progress onto a second album. I mean, but who knows? I don't know. I mean, I have no idea. But I definitely wouldn't rule it out. You know, I mean, we're already playing new material right now. So
excellent. All right. And in terms of touring, you guys have just kicked off your tour. I think you're about a week and a half into it now. How's it going so far?
It's good. It's weird on a few levels, but it's good. I mean, I think like again, I really don't have expectations, and I really don't know what to expect. So I just kind of, I don't know. It makes life more interesting that way. You kind of roll into something, and you're not there's not a lot of room for disappointment when you're not like expecting something specific, you know, and you're like, that's cool, you know, this is good. I mean, fuck, none of us died and none of us ended up in jail for very long yet. So, I mean, everything seems pretty good.
And any plans for international tours?
There is talk, but as far as I know, nothing's been booked yet. So, I mean, I don't see why we wouldn't, you know.
All right. Well, we've got listeners in South America and Australia and around the world that have been asking me to ask that question here. So
I've been asking myself that same question. So I'm ready, man. Like, tell all of them, like, I'm fucking ready. As soon as someone says yes, I'm all about it.
Oh, well, Justin, I really hope to see you guys out here at some point. I know a lot of people around the globe do as well. The Dead Cross album is fantastic. Really encouraging folks to pick it up. I think those who are aware probably have already checked it out. If you haven't, make sure you go to 31g.com. That's T-H-R-E-E-O-N-E. letterg.com and check out the Dead Cross album. Also, check out the rest of the 31G catalog. There's a heap of great stuff out there. Poke around, listen to some stuff, have a new experience. Thank you very much for being on the show, Justin. Much appreciated, and have fun
Thank
out
you.
There on the road.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much for coming on The Vinyl Guy, Justin. Much appreciated. Everyone, make sure you see this band, Dead Cross. Facebook.com/DeadCrossOfficial for all the tour dates, and pick up their album at 31g.com. Alrighty, that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks again for listening. Everyone, make sure you leave some positive feedback in iTunes. Say you love this show. Give us 5 stars. Say all sorts of good stuff. See if you can make me blush. And be much appreciated. It helps us in chart position. Helps us get new listeners. Helps build the Vinyl Guide community. And much appreciated for you guys doing that. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode. So until then, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @VinylGuide. Until next time, keep spinning.